This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Carla Malden, who is a former screenwriter and a novelist, an author of nonfiction books, and someone I've known for a really long time. It's nice to have you here, Carla.
It's lovely to be here, David.
So you've written a new book that's called Playback. Doesn't say it on the cover, but it's a novel. There's a novel referred to as previous to this one that has the main character in this book in it. But I have not read that first book. Yeah. From reading this one, I can tell you don't have to have read the prior book to read this one. But before we talk about Playback, could you talk a little bit about the earlier book?
Absolutely. That one was called Shine Until Tomorrow. And as you said, it features the same main character, Mari Caldwell. In that book, she's 17 years old, and she's the product of a divorced family, and she's bitter, and she's sort of a miserable, angsty teenager who's also very bright and very verbally adept and kind of uses her verbal facility to keep people at a distance and to help herself feel superior to her peers, which is sort of critical to a lot of teenagers when they're really just feeling weird and different and separate. So anyway, in that book, at Shine Until Tomorrow, through a strange quirk of fate that we never quite know, is it a Wizard of Oz sort of bump on the head, or is it really happening? I won't spoil anything. She ends up traveling back in time to San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury, the summer of love, 1967, where she falls in love with a singer-songwriter by the name of Jimmy, and has a whole weekend there that basically, in terms of the arc of her character, cracks open her heart and lets her learn to, she's at the beginning of the book, she's just focused on getting to Yale. We meet her when she's about to be a senior in high school. She's focused on getting to Yale. She's obsessed with the future because she so dislikes her present. So the put it on a Western Union Telegram version of the book is that it's about a girl obsessed with the future who has to travel back to the past in order to learn to live in the present.
That's pretty so good. Yeah.
That's Shine Until Tomorrow. And I must say, I'm thrilled to hear you say that in reading Playback, you didn't feel you were missing out on any backstory. That was one of the things that was the biggest challenges in writing Playback, and the thing I worked the hardest on was to make sure that it would completely stand on its own two feet as a piece of work, but yet also be, you know, sufficiently enriched had you read the first one, or maybe want to even send people back to read the first one.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that it made me want to read the first one because there's enough about the events of the first book that become part of the second book that I understand fully what's going on in the second book, but I want to know more about her. So I think in that way, or maybe I like, and I will confess, I really like time travel novels. Like as a genre, it's one of my favorites. So and there aren't that many that I've read that I really like, but so liking this book means that I am going to end up wanting to read the first book, because I'm going to guess that if I like this one, I will like the first one.
I hope you will. Well, interestingly, I wrote the first one, Shine Until Tomorrow. I conceived it and sort of thought I was writing it as a YA book, as a young adult book. Mm-hmm. But when it got out into the world, pleasant surprise, it really crossed over to the adult marketplace. So this one, Playback, I wrote as an adult novel, though I think it could also be YA. So they both have sort of spanned the gap. And in this one, our heroine, Mari, is now 34 years old, so exactly twice as old as she was in the first one. And again, not giving too much away, again, she finds herself going back to what is not actually the summer of love, but the fall of that year. She lands in October 1967, which was, I have to say, was very interesting to research for me, because I guess maybe I had just never thought about it, but the summer of love turned out to have been a really discrete sort of period of time. It was the summer. And by October, things were starting to erode the optimism, the idealism, all the things I wanted to take advantage of in terms of the zeitgeist of the time. When I sent her back there in the first book, I wanted them to be deteriorating in this book, because the lessons she has to learn as a character really sort of depend as much on that as they do the positive aspects of the 60s.
You know, one of the things that I like about the book is that you are realistic about the period, we'll call it the 60s, but it is that very specific place and time, which is the summer of love or the fall of the summer of love in San Francisco. Because I think it was, that's sort of a crucible location for a lot of the cultural changes that affected the entire country, you know, were really going on in that one place.
Absolutely. And it was drawing teenagers from all over the country. So it, she is able to sort of blend in. At first, they think, you know, she's like every other kid there and she's a runaway. So the fact that she's from a different time is not so obvious. And yeah, absolutely. And I chose that period for a variety of reasons, but thematically, because it's so diametrically opposed to the period in which we find ourselves now. I mean, again, I bring up optimism, idealism, the sense that the individual can affect change in the world. Very much in both books is the idea that music can affect change in the world. Music is sort of almost a character. So yeah, it was chosen with great specificity, that whole period and location.
But you know, it's sort of thinking about that also, there is a tendency to romanticize that period for the people in my generation, our generation. We're a similar age. You're young, but you know, we're a similar age. And now we're called boomers, which I hate, but the people who were young then have a tendency to romanticize that period pretty heavily. And I think you avoided that, even at the same time that you were celebrating some of the elements of it that we do. The reason that we romanticize it is because it was a special period of time.
And I think also because there was so much change. I think change feels so daunting right now. And in a very short period of time, I mean, if you look at the Beatles, of course, the title of the first book, Shine Until Tomorrow, comes from the song Let It Be. So if you look at the Beatles in from whatever it was, 63 to 69, they had this little tiny tenure, you know, but have they changed in music and in appearance and culturally is just extraordinary. So I think that the 60s have kind of come to symbolize that.
Yeah, well, but it was a period of amazing change, and it did happen very quickly. And as you were sort of alluding to, that change also continued to happen, so that the promise of that kind of optimism in that period eroded very quickly. You know, it was sort of like the Woodstock to Altamont.
That's exactly right.
It happened so fast.
Right.
And you have this sort of anodyne of, you have Woodstock making people feel like, oh my God, there's a, you know, the culture is moved in this massive way. We are really, truly able to live together in ways that didn't seem possible before. And then 6 months or 3 months later, you have, you know, a nightmare.
And this is very similar. In the first book, it is a little rosier, and it is very much all the promise and potential of the summer of love. And in this book, Playback, as I said, she lands in October. It's literally and metaphorically the fall of the summer of love. And she encounters, without getting too much away, the hippie funeral. All of that is real. All of that was researched, including some of the dialogue and the posters, everything. So yeah, they had a funeral for the hippie because they felt like all the magic of the summer of love had been co-opted by the media.
Well, you know, because of the magic of YouTube, it is now possible to view home movies of that period that I've watched it. You mentioned the Human Bean, I think, in San Francisco. I can't remember what month that was.
I think it was June.
There was a Human Bean in New York that I went to as a young, you know, hippie wannabe. And I wanted to, you know, you have memories of things that happened in places you were, and they all get fuzzy over time. But I found on YouTube, somebody did a home movie of virtually the entire, well, not the whole thing, but an hour or so of it.
Right. Well, that makes doing research for books like this such a pleasure now, you know?
Right. You get to see like how, and I think for people who are reading, even though I truly believe that you have to read a book and imagine for yourself what is happening and who the people are and try to place it in your mind. No, don't go see the movie first, you know, but still it is really, if you're young enough to have not experienced the 60s, it is worth it to go back and, or to go now back into time yourself and to look at some of the videos or film or movies that are now videos that people took of that time, because it's really interesting.
It's fascinating. It really is. And again, I have to reiterate, and so different from the times we're living in right now in so many ways. It's just, it couldn't be more different.
Well, I was trying to think about why I responded so viscerally to this book. You know, aside from the fact that I like the narrative, I like the way the characters interact. I think it's really complicated and interesting. I think the period is really meaningful to me. So I kind of have an emotional connection to it. I think what it made me feel like is I really wish I could go back in time.
I know. A number of people have said that, I have to say. Yeah, I completely understand that. And I love that. And I hope that the experience of reading the book transports people to that time.
Yeah. But do you feel, have you read other time travel novels, you know, for your own?
It's a really interesting question. I read a number of them, particularly YA ones, when I was working on the first book, Shine Until Tomorrow. Weirdly, I am not a huge time travel person. I think of the time travel in this story in Playback as the mechanism that allows her character to grow. As a writer and as a reader, I'm sort of more interested in the arc of the character and the obstacles and challenges that they face and how they work around them than I am sort of an external device being imposed upon them. That said, I felt like time travel was the perfect thing for this, because she, in Playback, as I said, she's now 34 years old when we meet her. She does go back in time, and she has her 34-year-old adult self and all those experiences inside of her. But to the people around her, in one of those weird time travel things, she appears to be 17. So right, they are able to relate to her as though they just saw her a few months ago and she's the same teenager. So that allowed me to really have fun with that sort of dichotomy and her, you know, trying not to give herself away, her still being in love or re-falling in love with the singer-songwriter, but she also is now a divorced mother. So that allowed a lot of complexities that were really fun to play with.
Right. She know, well, that's true. I could tell that your use of time travel was not the same as some of the other books I've read that use time travel in maybe a different way. You have her not pining for the past. This is not I was better in the past, or the past is better and more vivid. I really belong in 1967. As you just said, her present life is what matters.
Right. Although I agree, and I'll add to that a little bit disagreeing, in that I think when we meet her at the beginning of the book, she is kind of trapped by that weekend that she spent 17 years ago with this guy, her first love. And it has colored her, it colored her marriage, it colors her whole present life in ways she's not anywhere near conscious of. So she does have to revisit that in order to be able to free herself from it.
But you don't really know that at the beginning.
No, you don't. I'm telling you that.
Right.
Right. You don't know that.
Before talking to you, I went back and reread the beginning. I almost always do this with books that I read. By the time I've finished reading the book, I'm into I've traveled the arc of the story. I'm no longer as cognizant of where I started. So when I want to talk to the writer of the book, I have to refresh my memory of what the book was like when I first started reading it and didn't know where I was going to end up. And what I realized in looking at the beginning of the book is that I wasn't aware as much of her psychological ish, you know, like her
attachment to the past.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't find that out right away.
Good.
You know, she's not a tortured soul.
No. She's, I think when we meet her, she's disillusioned with her present life. She's disappointed. She's disheartened. She has disappointed herself. All those things really apply more to herself. She's disappointed herself. She has gotten divorced, giving her little girl, who is really, in my opinion, the North Star relationship in this book, is her and her little girl. So she's, you know, she's thrust her little girl into a quote unquote broken home in the way that she was, which was something she never wanted to do. So she's disappointed herself. She's really let herself down. She, you know, she wanted to be a photographer. She had artistic aspirations. She wanted to photograph, you know, album covers and rock stars and have pictures on the cover of Rolling Stone. When we meet her, she's photographing empty staged houses to sell them. So it's, you know, she's got a lot of disappointment. She doesn't have a miserable life. She's just let herself down. And right. She's very hard on herself.
Which actually, in many respects, reflects the predicament of our generation, that without even realizing it, we did not fulfill our wishes, hopes, and dreams of the 60s, the counterculture period, through accident or no fault of your own, just living your life. A lot of those loftier sentiments and beliefs of the 60s, they're not lived. They're not worked through. And people wonder why it is that they are where they are and who they are. And I think that, you know, so what you've just described is actually our reality.
Exactly. And she's, you know, several generations down. She's 34. So I think I have a line in the book where I say that she has nostalgia for a time that wasn't even hers. So it's at one remove for her, yet still equally kind of crippling in her life.
Yeah. But it kind of is a disappointment that a lot of people have.
I think so.
And maybe it isn't maybe every generation feels that way. I don't know.
Well, it's unfortunately, we're given to understand that's sort of part of growing up, is that you let go of the frivolous dreams or thinking you can change the world and you just live your little life in its narrow path. I think what the 60s left us with was the idea that that didn't necessarily have to be the case, but it has turned out to be for her.
Right. Yeah, which I think makes her human.
Exactly. I hope so.
Very relatable. But yeah, I was thinking of, just as you were talking, trying to figure out the difference between, I haven't really thought about it this way, so I don't have a clear idea, but you know, my favorite time travel novel was a book called Time and Again by Jack Finney. And there was, I can't remember the full story, but it takes place in New York. He goes back to New York in the 1800s. And I think his starting point was earlier because he wrote the book in the, probably in the 70s or eight. Yeah. 70s, I think. So, you know, you're even starting your book when his book, you know what I mean? It's sort of thinking about time travel. Yeah. He's like another generation almost. Another interesting book is called If I Never Get Back. And that kind of title, he goes back 100 years to in the 1860s, where I think going back that far in time creates technical issues that you don't have to deal with, because she, although I love some of the stuff where she I hope this is not giving it away, but there are things where she uses language that doesn't exist in the 1960s, references that don't exist, but then you kind of have the fun of her leaving them behind. So you participate in that historical anomaly.
Right, right. And even though maybe she doesn't go back as many years as these other novels you're referencing, the technology, today's technology is so extreme that you don't have to go back too far to have it be a completely different life. You know, that's, I set the first book, Shine Until Tomorrow, in 2007, which I chose quite specifically because that was the year that the iPhone came out.
Right.
But, obviously the technological explosion since then has been so enormous that going back to the 60s now is bizarre for her. And she actually hides her phone away for a variety of reasons that we won't talk about. But yeah, it's not having a phone, not having Google Maps when she's lost, all of these things are bizarre to her.
And they were so normal. I think that you do highlight how quickly technology has changed culture and expectation. I was talking about this with somebody today, like just in business stuff, about how technology is changing human behavior again at a really rapid rate. So if you did and we have no idea what it's going to turn out to be, but you can imagine the rate of change is, typically accelerated.
Yeah, logarithmically, year to year.
Yeah, the idea that you don't have a phone, but it isn't just the phone that you don't have. You don't have in your hand all of this power.
Exactly.
That they take for granted.
Right.
You know, it reminds us, I think I was telling one of my kids about this. You know, I hitchhiked cross country in 1972. When I got out of college, and I went with a woman who wanted to get to San Francisco to see her boyfriend. She didn't want to go alone. And so I wanted to get to California so I could visit friends. And it was great I got to go really fast because we got a lot of rides and she was safer. But if you think, I cannot believe that our parents let us go for days. First of all, how do you get in touch with people? Like, remember, no, like you have to find a payphone.
Well, there's a scene in the book, I don't know if you remember, where she and this guy, Jimmy, who she's with again, decide to go to the movies. They're going to go see Don't Look Back, the Bob Dylan movie. And, they have to find a newspaper. They have to find a newspaper stand with a newspaper to look it up in the newspaper and find out, where it's playing, what time it goes on, all of the stuff that would be one click, 3 seconds. And then you start to think, so what are we doing with all that extra time that we've been granted by having all this power in our hands?
Exactly.
Scrolling through junk,
You have all that extra time, but are you using it ask people how they divide up their, I wish somebody was around who could, maybe somebody did this, measuring the amount of time each of us spent doing X, Y, or Z in 1975 or 1980 before the advent of smartphones, the internet. What did people do? They read, maybe they watched TV, they talked on the phone, but it was not iPhone,
You had to dial the phone.
But you had to compete with the rest of the people in your family.
Right. How about the phone would ring and you'd say, I'll get it with great excitement,
Right. Or if it was a long distance phone call you were on, maybe you were calling your boyfriend in another state with your parents, most likely your father, leaning over saying, you need to get off the phone now because it's 25
caustic.
Minutes. And our parents grew up during the Depression, so it didn't matter whether they had enough money to pay the phone bill. They felt it was wrong to be on the phone.
Right, right. No, they never got over that Depression mentality. That's for sure.
Did people spend more time productively, constructive, but maybe some of it wasn't productive and constructive. You know, you were spending time with your friends, more time.
Well, it was more engaged. My personal bias is that I think it was more engaged with other people.
Yeah.
You know, with actual humans.
That's what I mean. It may not have been that every moment that you were with your friends or people that you, or your family was productive in the greater sense, but it was productive in the sense that it built relationships.
Right. It would fed some sort of human connection.
Right. And maybe, you know, and I know it begins to sound like we are lamenting the present the way our parents lamented that present, but it is true that you would spend more time with, let's say, the grandmas, the grandpas, the aunts, the uncles, the cousins. I think that is probably something that most people recognize is
right.
People spend less time with their
extended family.
Yeah.
Yeah. My family happens to be the exception to that, for which I'm extremely grateful, but it is definitely for sure a valid generalization.
I wonder too if, I mean, there are other things that, you know, that are just different from now and then, but the explosion of people moving to other places that also is an affordance of technology, I think.
Right.
You know, it's easy to move from one place to another. This country is less, like in the 60s, if you went from here, well, from wherever you grew up in an urban area to a smaller town, there would be noticeable cultural differences. Whereas,
especially post-pandemic, when we all got used to working from home, now you take your job with you.
Right.
You don't even necessarily have to change jobs.
And there are Starbucks in every town. That every place is more the same
right.
than it was
right.
then. There are fewer local anythings.
Well, there's a quick little anecdote. There's a place near where I live called the Brentwood Country Mart that you may or may not remember, in sort of the border of Brentwood and Santa Monica. And it's like a little mini farmer's market from West Hollywood. Little stalls, little mom pop kind of businesses. They are no longer. Now there's a Christian Louboutin, and there are all kinds of things. A number of years ago, shortly before George Carlin passed away, a realty consortium came in to try to take it over. And all of us fought and fought and fought, and we succeeded. They didn't knock the buildings down. It still looks the same. Different stores now occupy it. But I have a vivid memory of being in a meeting, a steering committee meeting to save the Brentwood Country Mart, with George Carlin talking about exactly that, how he traveled the country, going from theater to theater, doing shows, and how everything now looked the same. And I remember him in his voice saying, there's always a Haagen-Dazs, like in that way that he had. But it was true. And that was a number of years ago, obviously, because he's been gone a long time. But that was the first time I really thought about how homogenized the country was, because he had just been on the road.
Right. No, I think it's true. And I think it's maybe that's another good reason to read your book, because you are introducing and exploring place and time that is different from our own. And that
right.
that enriches your experience, you know, the other, experiencing the other, whether it's some place you've never been before or people you've not met before, or I guess a time you've never been in before.
I hope so.
Yeah, I think that's really good. Well, we did end up talking about a lot of different things, but we'll circle back to Playback. And that is, will there be another novel about Mari and her?
I'm going to answer that honestly and say, I don't know. It's not impossible, but I don't have it It's on a back burner at this point. I don't know.
So are you writing another novel now?
I'm in the very ground floor stages of something.
And how long does it usually take you to
You know, it? It has really varied. Playback was by far the fastest. From germ of the idea to completion was under a year and a half, which is really fast for me. But I knew these people already.
Right.
You know, I didn't have to get acquainted with them. And in fact, I was working on some, I had finished something else. I had finished my book called My Two and Only, which had a lot of sort of structural challenges and had been a hard one for me. I really, really enjoyed it. I'm very proud of it, but it took a lot out of me. I finished that, sort of caught my breath, started working on just making notes on something else, and it just wasn't quite coalescing. And literally, David, I sat down at my desk one night about 9 o'clock, and so I'll just play and see what I've got to say. And there truly was like the first 4 pages of Playback. I just wasn't, Mari wasn't quite done with me. More than I wasn't quite done with her, she wasn't quite done with me. And it just sort of took off from there. So I'm kind of working on something else, not sure yet.
Well, I have heard that from writers before, that the character had not, wasn't done with them. I think that you won't know until the moment when Mari comes back, or maybe she doesn't, maybe she's done.
I like her a lot. I mean, she's so much fun for me that let me leave it this way. If I can come up with something that seems as meaningful and as much fun as this was, I'll do it.
Will remain to be seen then.
Yes, it will.
Find out what happens. Well, I really want to thank you for doing this. It was really fun talking to you.
Oh, my absolute pleasure.
I'm hoping that there will be another novel with Mari, but we'll see.
Okay.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Carla Malden about her novel, Playback. Thank you very much.